You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is James Pritchett, known to nearly everyone in the cage world as the author of The Music of John Cage, published by Cambridge University Press in 1993, which remains to date the only survey available of all of Cage's music. Equally important, if more finely focused, is his 1988 doctoral dissertation for New York University, The Development of Chance Techniques in the Music of John Cage, 1951 to 1956, which provides detailed insight into the processes Cage used in his seminal chance compositions. Pritchett continues to write about Cage, but he's also expert on the work of the late American composer Morton Feldman, as well as his wife, the composer Frances White, with whom he's collaborated on a number of works that involve video, poetry, and storytelling. One collaboration they've yet to realize is a radio play about a fully sentient house. You can read a bit about Pritchett's life and a lot about his work at his website, where you can also access his marvelous blog, The Piano in My Life. So welcome to All Things Cage, James. It's a pleasure to have you here. I realized the other day in reconnecting with you that you and I have known each other for going on 35 years.
Yeah.
We met at John Cage's loft in, we think, 85, perhaps 86. When you were preparing your dissertation. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I started going up there in the fall of 1984. I had just decided I was going to write my dissertation about the chance pieces from the 50s, and I wanted to know how they were composed. That summer, the summer of 84, what locked me into that was I went to New York Public Library. And I had gone through, you know, it used to be you got the whole New York Public Library music collection catalog in a book. They did photographs of all of the cards in the card catalog. And that's how, from wherever, you could sit down and search it, the good old days. And I had, of course, gone through to look up every single Cage holding they had. And there was a card there in the card catalog for Two Pastorals. And the description of it was this notebook with some loose paper and like not a score, like not the Peters published score. And I said, well, that sounds interesting. One day in the summer, I said, I'm going to go up there and see what that thing is. And went there. It was in the special collections, had to get them to pull the thing out for me. And it was the notebook that had all of the materials for the composition of the first of the two pastorals, and also water music is in there as well. All the materials for water music. The charts, there were two loose pages that had all of the numbers, the I Ching numbers that had come up for composing it. And I think there's a draft of the score in there. It's been literally that long since I've seen that thing. So, but when I looked at it, I transcribed, you know, I copied everything out and went through it and realized I could completely recreate the whole way that those two pieces were composed based on the materials that were there. And in my naive mind at the time, I thought, great, all I got to do is find this for every other piece that Cage ever wrote, and I'll know exactly. Because, you know, he would talk about chance operations, and there's a description of Music of Changes, which is pretty detailed, but you still are not totally clear reading it. But all the rest of them, who knows how they were done, right? And you could make it really concrete. I said, great, I want to do this. So I wrote to Cage in 1984, right after that experience, and said, I'm this grad student, I'm doing this research. I'd love, if you've got any of those kinds of materials, I'd like to see them. And he immediately wrote back to me and said, call me and come on up. And I started going there in 1984. And as you know, he had drawers full of all kinds of papers there. And Andrew Culver had recently organized a lot of them, which was really helpful.
They were in the
flat. I went every week doing that. Yeah, they were in the flat files.
They were all
in the flat files. Yeah.
We'll get to this in a second, you know, that James, you were part of the team of musicologists who were brought together after Cage died, fast forwarding years later. Between the manuscripts in the Cage Cunningham loft and the manuscripts, residual kinds of things at Peters that they had used as reproduction materials, there were something like 28,000 pieces of paper.
Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, a lot of things were gone. He didn't save all, to my dismay, those notebooks and, lists of numbers that he had for the past roles did not exist for majority of the pieces. And there were other kinds of materials and bits and pieces of it, that I worked with. But I spent from 84 probably into 86. I mean, I went there every week for months, just cataloging what's here and trying to understand what they represented and transcribing bits of them. I mean, I was in awe of Cage at that point because I had been just obsessed with that work for years. I lived in mortal fear of imposing upon him. Oh my God, that would be the last thing I would want to do,
I
which
told
in
you that.
retrospect seems amusing, right? Because
I remember I told you this, that one of the things that I remember about the two of you is you always calling him Mr. Cage and him turning up to you and smiling at you and saying, "Yes, Dr. Pritchett."
well, Mr. Pritchett, at that point, I had not gotten my doctorate.
I
I
think
don't.
he was anticipating it for you. He was getting you used to it. But that begs the question, was Cage helpful to you in identifying things, relating to things 20, 30 years before?
No, not at all. Yeah, I mean, they were already sorted, thank goodness. So a lot of that work had been done. Some things were in the wrong places, and we kind of sorted that out. That's typical. They're probably still in the wrong places. I bet if you go to NYPL, that'll happen. And I look forward to some young whippersnapper musicologist coming up and saying, "Oh, these old fogies, Pritchett and Van Emmerich and Wilhelm and all. What do they think this thing was this? They were totally wrong." So a couple of things. One, he didn't remember a lot of that stuff. And he was also, as I'm sure you remember, he was interested in the piece he was writing right now. The piece a month ago was ancient history, much less that many years ago. I had the really interesting experience not that long ago. I was working on some writing, I think when I was writing about the silent pieces on my blog, and I needed to look up something about the way that some pieces were written in the 1950s. And I said, "Well, my dissertation's sitting right here. I haven't looked at that in a while. And I think for sure I must have written about this, right?" And I started looking the thing up and on the way read about this other piece that I had completely forgotten about. And I'm reading this in my dissertation, this very interesting and like really coherent analysis of it, and having no memory of ever having thought that, written that, done that. And then it just suddenly dawned on me, oh, yeah, well, that was because that was like 30 years ago. And I said, and that's how long it was between when I was doing this research and when John wrote all of those pieces in the 50s. I'm coming 30 years later in the 80s. And I was like, I totally get it now. Of course, he didn't remember those details.
This reminds me, I'm going to jump us out of sequence a little bit, but it reminds me how wonderfully useful you were to Cage, fast forwarding into the late 70s. So for listening audience, he wrote this piece for solo violin for Paul Zukofsky, who actually helped him write for violin. And he wrote this book one of this work called The Freeman Etudes, named for Betty Freeman. It was dedicated to her. He had done the first book. Paul Zukofsky played it and then told Cage that it was really unplayable, that it was just not, it was too hard, there were too many notes, blah, 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 blah. Fast forward a little bit, and Cage is at a performance by Irvine Arditi, who plays it absolutely flawlessly. And Cage goes to Irvine and he says, "How do you play this so well if Paul can't play it?" And Paul had complained about play as fast as possible. And Irvine said, "Oh, I just translated that into my head as play as many notes as fast as possible." And Cage loved that. And he decided that he was going to do this the second pair of books, so books three and four. But he couldn't remember how he composed it. So he came back to New York and saw you and said, "Maybe James could help." And you deciphered from his notes how he had done the first two books, and he was able to complete the work.
Oh, yeah, it was even worse than that, though, Laura, because. Oh, and let me tell you, I was so happy to be able, as I said, to use musicology for good rather than evil. So, to use it to help him to compose. So the detail in the story is not a, he had actually started writing the second half of the, he had was continuing to write them, and midway through, I can't remember which etude, the way the chance operations had happened, it was ferociously dense. There were an enormous, like more than any of the other etudes. And so, yeah, hearing this from Zhukovsky that that stuff wasn't possible, I'm not even going to bother finish composing this thing because no one will ever, ever, ever be able to play it. So he actually stopped in middle of one etude, of a really dense, complex etude. He stopped right there.
Was this book three or book four? Where are
Oh, books one and two were
where
done.
stuff?
I think it was in book three that he conked out. He had composed maybe the first one or two, and then this was maybe the third one in book three, or so it was in the middle of it. And he had all the materials where he had, all the manuscript stuff and all of, what that he was using in the process of composing it. But he just didn't remember where he left off. And I remember him calling me up, telling me this dilemma that he was now going to finish it, but he needed to know where to start. Like, where do I pick up and what am I doing? And so he gave me all the materials and I took him home I was living in Princeton at the time, and figured out and wrote him a report for it and submitted it. And he insisted that he pay for the services,
I
which.
remember this vividly, vividly. He was so grateful to you.
Well, and I was unemployed at the time, and I think he wanted to help me out, give me a job. So instead of hiring me to water the plants or something, he hired me to figure out how to finish doing Freeman etudes. And when I gave it to him, there was still some things I wasn't sure about, but it was enough for him. He was like, "Oh, yep, I know what I got to do." And he finished writing the rest of it and very generously gave me a credit on the title page, which I've always treasured.
We're so spoiled now, people don't realize that during Cage's lifetime, he was the primary source, that he had the manuscripts. He was maybe not the didn't have the strongest memory about things, but he was very generous in terms of giving people access to materials and answering however he could. And now it's all neatly divided. We have the manuscripts over at NYPL, we have the scores over at Peters.
Yeah, everything is very, very tidy.
Together. Yes, it's very tidy. But at the time, it wasn't so tidy.
And he was so incredibly generous. So the first time I went up there, the first day I met him and went up, and he showed me where the papers were, and I spent most of the day going through and figuring it all out, what was there, just doing a broad inventory of what compositions were represented, trying to figure out how I'm going to attack this. And I remember as I was getting ready to leave, we were talking about some piece, and he says, "Oh, do you have a score for that?" And I was like, "Oh no, I'll have to, get that." And he told me, "Oh, you shouldn't have to pay what Peter's charges." And he went into a closet there right next to the kitchen, and he had a bunch of scores in there. And he just started handing me stuff. "Oh, do you have this piece? No, well, here, take this. Here, do you have this piece?" And he must have given me like $200 plus. He gave me the score for the solo for piano. That thing right there was like $75, I
How
think, at
did
the
you get it
time.
home? I mean, that was, that
It
was.
was a big, I just took a big pile of stuff with me. I think he probably gave me a bag. And I was just shocked. I have now this collection, including the copy of the two pastorals he gave me is self-published. It was not the Peters, because a lot of those pieces he self-published or did through the composer, what was the group that Henry Cowell put together,
New
right?
Musical Quarterly, New Musical Report.
Whatever it was. Yeah, they had their, that they published stuff. He had a number of things that were self-published that way before they went to Peters from like the early 50s.
Two memories come up about that closet for me. One very much like yours, which is when I finished my dissertation, which was in early 92. Page was, we were just sitting around having lunch, maybe, or talking, and he said, "Are you going to publish your dissertation?" And I said, I had no idea whether or not I would. It's of singular work. And he said, "Well, you need to make it available." And I said, "Well, it's problematic because the appendices in my dissertation are color costume documentation." So I don't know how many pages, but 80 pages. And at that time, to publish paper copy, we didn't have the internet this way,
Yeah,
And
right.
I
No.
was telling him, I said, every single dissertation that somebody wants is, we're talking $80, $90 for this book, for me to print it out. And he just ambled over into that closet and came back with a stack of $100 bills and said, "Will this help?" And he gave us like $1,200 or something. And I said, "Yeah." It was money that, Marguerite Roeder was his art gallerist, and she would sell works in Europe, and she'd come home with cash for him, and he would put it in the closet. So he was incredibly generous.
And that's why I answer anybody who sends me an email about asking a question about it, I always answer, because I feel like I owe it to John to do that.
That's how I have always felt running the Cage Trust, as long as I have, that following Cage's generosity and attending performances. If people did something of his work, he would go. If at all possible, he would be there. Feels like forever ago that I attended concerts.
Yeah, right. Back in the dim time when we had those things.
Exactly. But I used to, travel an enormous amount just to be present for people's work, to see what they were doing. Yeah. And I tell people, that the truth is that generosity of Cage, the very big way, had to do with the formation of the John Cage Trust. Because when Cage died, the interest in his work and the need for access to everything didn't stop. So there were a lot of people left potentially high and dry when he died. So fell on poor me and Merce to be available to these people. It's like, what do you need? Let me see if I can find that. So that really caused us to solidify something called the John Cage Trust, to make a space, to give it a fax machine, to give it a Xerox machine, to give it stuff so we can actually help people.
And I think about all the hours I spent manually transcribing all kinds of stuff out of those documents. And when all I had to do was ask him to take it down to Kinko's, and I could have photocopied all that stuff, which I ultimately did do for the figures in my dissertation. I had to have reproductions of all that stuff. And he said, oh, absolutely. So I'm taking all of these manuscripts down to the local Kinko's there and getting them photocopied and bringing back. Or maybe I took them down to NYU and did it in the office. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, I can't lose any of this stuff, right? These are really important papers. But I would have just been, aghast at asking him for these things and being a bother in any way. So people, would think, oh, well, I was there every week for months, every single week, and then I would drop in periodically when I had questions and needed to relook at stuff. I almost never talked to him. I don't think I ever interviewed him about anything. All of my colleagues used to think, oh, well, why don't you just ask him this stuff, And I was like, well, he's not going to remember any of that. They had no idea how composers worked, but I left him alone. I would come there, he would let me in, and then my memory is I'm sitting in the round table with a bunch of papers, and he was either back in the computer room with Culver doing something, or he was largely in the kitchen cooking something. I would occasionally get lunch or definitely tea. And I was just doing this stuff for the papers. And I just felt that, well, I was doing him a favor by not harassing him. I'm just sort of quietly doing this thing. And it was only in 1986 that I felt that I kind of crossed into where I could actually talk to him, because I sent him the first chapter out of my dissertation that I had worked on. I had just figured out, it was about the Concerto for Prepared Piano and Chamber Orchestra, and I had completely recreated that system about how it was composed. And those materials actually were in the possession of David Tudor, not Cage. It was stuff that Tudor, as he said, John was throwing them out and he was pulling them out of the trash can. But I figured that out, which was one of my favorite memories of doing that research, was when it all dawned on me that this was the piece where he first used the I Ching to do the composition and how that worked. And so I started there and I wrote that chapter. And I said, well, I got to send it to Cage to see if it's right, if he has anything to do about it. And I was, of course, terrified as I'm packing this into an envelope to mail it to him. I was living in Brooklyn, right? I'm not going to go by. I'm going to mail it to him and just sort of see what happens. I mailed it on a Thursday. And Saturday morning, Frances and I were just talking about this because we were living together in Brooklyn. Get this call. She answered the phone. And, oh, it's John. He was so excited. He said, oh, it made him want to compose.
That's so lovely.
Because it brought back a moment of discovery for him. I think it's like the pivotal thing in his composing was when he discovered that method for the last movement of the concerto. And I've written about this now like three or four times. That sudden opening that door of yes, this is how chance operations is going to make everything work. And of course, totally, you know, that's what he did for the rest of his life. Then I felt like, okay, yeah, that now I had a different relationship with him after that. And he was very enthusiastic about everything. He had seen nothing of what I was doing. He had no idea what I was doing. And then I sort of shoved that under the door. You
know? It's interesting to hear you talk about this because it's something we see a lot of people wanting to lean on the whole influence of Buddhism and actually just Eastern thought in general. But I remind them that it just, all of that was important because it led to chance operations. It led to a new way of working. That was the start. Whereas the interest in Eastern philosophy and all of that was the buildup to getting there. It was just a means.
Or it was just another force that was influencing his life at that time. But really, he was an avant-garde artist from the get-go and then throughout, right? That was his religion.
I think of his religion as being more truly experimental.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So this business about being truly experimental meant that to find a way of working that was about that, you know, that would result in that was critical. And so I'm sure you sending that chapter back to him reminded him of this, you know, I don't want to call it, it sounds so hokey to call it a breakthrough, but this opening, this door opening.
Oh, but that was a breakthrough. I mean, it is hokey, but it's true. So my take on the story these days is that it was the Feldman-Graf piece that pushed him into it. There's a number of things that he's trying to figure out, and Feldman almost kind of leaps past it because Feldman does this crazy thing of saying, I'm not even going to put notes on the page. And that's like a dare almost, you know. And that's why when you read the lecture on something, just that enthusiasm about what Feldman did is leaps off the page. It's ecstatic.
And what year is Lecture on Something?
1951. It's the same. It's when he's writing this concerto, right? It's when all of this has just happened. You can tell that he's had this breakthrough.
I agree. And it just reminds me of that beautiful quote by Feldman that's in Give My Regards to 8th Street, where he says, there was a time that we didn't have a clue what we were doing and it was marvelous.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's what it was. So, you know, Feldman's really the one who pushed him that way. And then John figures out the whole chance operations thing. And you can just imagine writing that last movement and seeing this thing appear in front of you, this sort of effortless thing. Of course, it totally changed what he was up to. And it was a real breakthrough. Yeah.
It's interesting though, James, isn't it? That even, you know, doing this radio program has been really interesting because offering guests a choice of what they'd like to hear or play. Maybe there's nothing associated that we're necessarily talking about, but you know, is there something that they want to hear? And it's almost always pre-champ, almost always, which I find fascinating because I associate the pre-chance works, the choice of pre-chance works with a less knowledgeable audience, not knowledgeable, that's not fair, but a less experienced audience with John Cage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, the prepared piano pieces are favorites, the string quartet in four parts, the things that are more obviously melodic. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're going to talk about Cheap Imitation today, which is beyond melodic.
I was going to say, you're setting me up now, because what am I going to do? I'm going to pull out Cheap Imitation. So, yeah.
It's true.
But thinking about Cheap Imitation and just what we were talking about, where I sent Cage the chapter on my dissertation and having that, not nostalgia, but that recognition of this, oh, when I did this, this thing that was really important to me in the past, right? And we've all had those experiences of remembering a time or even, yeah, like just me remembering having sent that to him or, you know, like, oh yeah, that was really important. I remember how that felt. And that's really the story of Cheap Imitation because it's going back to this deep love of Satie of the 40s, which has nothing to do with chance operations. It's all way before that. Love of that material. And it's so obvious to me that in 1969, when he's doing Cheap Imitation, part of what's happening is it's just bringing all that back to him.
Let me stop you here just for a second, and I'm going to just inform our audience what Cheap Imitation is. He composed this work originally for solo piano. it derived from an earlier 1947, he composed it, as James said, in 1969, but it derives from a much earlier 1947 arrangement, or 1944/1947, a one or two piano arrangement of Erik Satie's Socrate, which itself was composed in 1918. Cage altered it and renamed it to disguise its source due to Cage's inability to secure permission from Satie's publisher, Salabert. So his reworking resulted in a wholly new composition in one melodic line across three modal monophonic movements, notated quite conventionally. It served then as the accompaniment to Merce Cunningham's choreographic work called Second Hand. Cage didn't call his Socrate as he'd intended, but rather Cheap Imitation. So that's the work that we're going to be talking about today. It's one of Cage's more melodic works from the 60s. If you look at it in the context of the 1960s, it's actually quite remarkable.
It is. It's been on my mind because Mode Records is going to be releasing a CD soon, a performance by Aki Takahashi of Cheap Imitation and some other works as well, and asked me to write the booklet for it. And I was happy to do so because I'm always happy to write about Cheap Imitation. And so I was rereading and going through all of that. Where was I going with this?
Talk about the new arrangement.
Yeah, well, then there's the new arrangement, right, that's on the CD. So yes, so there's, in addition to the solo piano Cheap Imitation, there's also this Feldman arrangement of Cheap Imitation, which I was completely unaware of, that he did for Aki Takahashi in, I think it's 1980, 81. I just wrote about it.
It's 1980.
It's 1980. Thank you. Yeah. After her first year in Buffalo, he gave this to her as a parting gift. And it's an arrangement for piano, flute, and glockenspiel.
And so I will put up for the listening audience, we have on our broadcast page, I'll put up a couple pages from the score so they can see the color circles and how. But maybe you describe to us how Feldman made his arrangement, these blue and red circles, and what happened? How did that work?
So the Feldman arrangement, the score is just the published score of the solo piano Cheap Imitation. It's the Peters score. And it's just on the title page he's written, arrangement for Aki Takahashi. What he did was to take the score, and the notes that are to be taken by the flute are circled in blue, and the notes that are to be taken by the glockenspiel are circled in red. And if it doesn't have a circle, it's the piano. That's it. So this, the Cage score with all these blue circles and red circles on it around there. And in a couple of places, he does it with drawing stems, I think. They might be played together. But that's it. It's very colorful and beautiful. It also has a lot of cigarette burns in it because it's Feldman who was constantly smoking while he was working. It's actually a very beautiful, like, just seeing the copies of it that was shared with me, it just has Feldman written all over it. So it goes forward in this kind of handing off of the melody between the three instruments for the most part, until in the second movement he does this incredible maneuver indicating the piece is completely monophonic, so every system is just a single line. And one point in the second movement, he beams two systems together and indicates, oh yes, one should be played on the flute and one should be played on the piano at the same time. So in effect, he's making counterpoint out of this, sort of folding the line in half on itself. And he does this then in a number of other places after having done it. My theory is that he just looked at that particular passage and just visually looking at it said, oh, look at that. It would be beautiful for this to be, you know, counterpoint. And so he just beamed it to do that. And when you hear it, it's such a shock. You're just going through all this monophonic thing and all of a sudden there's counter. You're like, where did that come from?
Do you think, James, that Cage knew about this?
I have no idea. So I'm trying to think when the first performance would be of it.
I want to say it was 2016.
Yeah, I don't know that it was ever performed. Feldman gave it to Aki Takahashi as a gift as she was leaving. And she owns that original, I think, still, because she showed it to me. We did a FaceTime call and she got it out and was, John may never have seen it. She may never have done anything with it. She maybe played it in Japan or something. I'm not sure. I'd have to ask her about it. I never knew. And the technique of it is similar, not the same, but similar, this sort of hockety thing to the way that the orchestra version works.
Right. So
but the orchestra version was before that, right?
Right. So let's stop there for a second, just to inform people that Cage himself made arrangements of cheap imitation for other instruments. A couple that are that were never realized, like a version for violin and piano was never realized. There's a version for solo cello that was never realized. But there is a version for variable large ensemble in size varying 24 instruments, 59 and 94, if memory serves. That was from 72.
72, right. Yeah, that would have been before that.
And then the version for solo violin for Paul Zukofsky again, that was 77. So we have Cage himself making these different versions. And let's talk about the large ensemble version for a second, because wasn't that the one that was done in The Hague?
At Gaudeamus, yeah. They were supposed to perform it, and it was, he tells the story, it was the introduction of one of his books. Maybe it was Empty Words, I don't remember. One of them that, that he writes in the introduction about this horrible experience he had with the orchestra.
Right.
And that they, basically, they did like a lot of professional ensembles will do. They don't really rehearse until the last minute. And you can't do that with the orchestra version of Cheap Imitation because it's ferociously difficult. It's designed to be performed without a conductor.
That's literally the problem is that.
Yeah, that's of course. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's the combination of that plus the way in which it was done where in effect, I don't remember if it's every note or every half bar is a completely different orchestration, is randomly determined orchestration.
Right. So what that means that if you take a relatively simple melodic line of say 20 notes spread across a number of measures, that the various notes are handed off from one instrument to another.
So or groups have, of instruments, right?
You could have and so you have an orchestra that has to listen to the rest of the orchestra in a way that it's not used to listening. It's to following a conductor who says, now you, now you, now you, and that's not happening. And most, as James was starting to say, is that there's just not enough rehearsal time. It's not built into the system of a large orchestra knowing how to do that.
Yeah, it's just the financial realities of orchestra performance, right? Exactly. You just can't do that. So John came to that premiere and found everything in a shambles and was incensed and said he refused to allow them to do it.
No, he withdrew the statement that it was a premiere and he called it a public rehearsal.
Right, right.
So it is technically not the premiere of the work, even though it's in all the books that they
No,
he was just so angry about it. But it took years. Even now, it's not a work, number one, that's played very often by these large ensembles. Uh-huh. And when it is played, it's, you know, 9 times out of 10 done with a conductor.
Misses it. And he was insisted that there be no conductor for it. So it's had an unhappy story in that way. Yeah.
Yes. But I finally was able to hear it unconducted by the New World Symphony at the John Cage Centennial Festival that they did in 2013. It was 4/12, of course, but it opened in January, I think, of 13.
Yeah,
where
like
they ended up, Michael Tilson Thomas is the conductor, and he waffled a little bit about whether or not he should conduct it. He wasn't sure that the orchestra could handle it without it. And in the end, it was done unconducted. I have to tell you, I found it unbelievably moving to not only hear this work unconducted, which gave it a kind of palpable movement, different than a calculated movement or a conducted movement, but also to have the awareness that these players were playing within a context that they had no real experience playing in, but that I believed would change them forever, having done it. You know, it was so important to me that he do it without, I think, my unhappiness early on when he said he thought he would conduct it. I think my disappointment I like to
it's
think
what you have to do.
Mind,
yeah.
I was so unhappy. I just thought, oh, you too? You?
Yeah, good for you. I'm so happy you did that though. I've done it. I won't name names, but I've tried to psych people into doing that piece because I felt so bad for it. And there was somebody in particular who I said, oh yeah, it's too hard. No one will ever be able to, you know, to kind of do that thing of like, oh yeah, well, you know, even you probably wouldn't be able to make that come off, you know, that kind of thing, right? You know, just trying to like dare you. I double dog dare you to do
it. Reverse psychology.
Exactly. Oh, I completely confess to having done that. But, you know, one of the things that makes it an interesting piece, and I remember what I was going to say about that before I got distracted by thinking about Aki's beautiful performance. She was telling me about the premieres of Cheap Imitation in 1970 that in Japan and in places where she went to it, and that people were shocked. They were completely, it was almost scandalous to hear Cheap Imitation because these were in new music festivals in 1970 in Japan that she was describing to me of, you know what new music festivals, all the other pieces on the programs and what you would expect from Cage at that time, from 1960s Cage with electronics and everything. And then you hear this gentle, modal, monophonic solo piano piece, no preparations, no electronics, no anything, no silence. There's nothing in it, right? Yeah. And it's just this gentle thing. And everyone was totally shocked by this, by what the heck is he doing? Just as they would have been shocked by other stuff earlier in his career. And even, you know, you read what John said about it at the time. So in For the Birds, in his interviews with Daniel Charles, and which was also about 1970, right about the time that came out, he himself says, oh, this, I can't explain this piece. John would say it's completely outside of anything that I would consider essential in my work. And he makes this great statement, which I love, that yes, it's totally confused, but if I fall into confusion, it's due to love.
His absolute adoration of Satie.
Yeah, and that's what he reconnected with. Right. And my feeling is that that's a breakthrough for him of, you know, in the 50s, there was that whole thing in all of music of, we're going to make everything possible. Electronics has just come on the scene and, you know, we're going to explore the whole universe of sound, right? That's the connection between Cage and Boulez in the 50s, as they both want to use these very systematic methods to completely break open the world of music to everything. And he kind of painted himself in a corner around that because he kept pursuing that idea and ultimately kind of reached diminishing returns. And then you get the 60s, where there's not a very productive period for him, I think in part because he's a little stymied. And then this piece, which just getting reconnected to that 1940s deep love of this, all of the things about Satie, this, yes, the lyricism and the simplicity of it and the silence of it and the plainness of it, and the just reminded him of that again, and just of his love for music and composing. And what happens after that is this explosion of the songbooks and, you know, all these things that started happening in the 70s where he could compose again. Yeah. I think it's really psychologically important.
I think it was a really, really critical piece. And, you know, for absolutely no good reason, I always dismissed Cheap Imitation in my mind. I had never heard it. This is going way back. I hadn't heard it. Nobody had written anything critical about it. And when I finally heard it, it was in the context of a Cunningham performance of Secondhand in Washington, D.C. And I was blown away by, number one, the length of it, the substantialness of it. It wasn't a ditty.
It's like, is that about a half an hour or something?
It's like 35 minutes. In movements, it goes on and on.
But yeah, because it's exactly the size of Socrate, right? It had to be exactly the same size.
That's exactly right. But also what happened was, long after Cage's death, probably in the, I don't know, early aughts maybe, where I came across in the archives of
the Subtropics Experimental Festival of Music and Sound Art, headed up by Gustavo Matamoros.
He was doing a workshop with Cage at Broward Community College, in which Cage played Cheap Imitation, and he recorded it. Now, it's terrible. The recording is, you know, handheld. There's a lot of noise. But the absolute beauty of that piece as played by Cage, when you hear that, it even adds to that everything you were saying about its simplicity, its lyricism. It's so beautiful. And I remember playing it. Carolyn Brown, one of Cunningham's principal ballerinas, was at this talk that I gave, and I played this whole thing for this audience. And she came up to me afterwards and she said, oh, would you please give that recording to the Cunningham musicians so that when they do this, they can get something of that, the way that Cage played it. If anybody wants to hear that, do go to John Cage Fest website, to my blog. It's called Coon's Blog. You can find it just by looking up Cheap Imitation. And it's a video as well. So you can see you know, John Cage kind of hunched over this upright piano playing Cheap Imitation.
The love comes through, right? That piece is all about love.
That's
right?
Exactly what we were getting at.
It's and in doing the notes for the mode recording, I realized too, the way that that whole Feldman arrangement, it's all about these personal relationships and conversations. So Cheap Imitation is sort of a conversation between Cage and Satie. It tells you so much about Cage's own understanding of Satie. And I've been studying the piece more closely, and I'm going to write some stuff on my blog eventually about it, that the way that understanding the system and the way in which he composed it, it tells you about the way he heard Satie as well and what he felt was important about it, or, you know, wanted to do. But yeah, that's a conversation between Cage and Satie. And then Feldman comes along, and of course Cage and Feldman had, you know, this lifetime of long conversations. I love reading about them walking around, you know, lower Manhattan in the 50s together, having these endless conversations about music and art, right? And so this Feldman's thinking about that as he's, you know, hearing all these Satie pieces, because when Aki Takahashi came to Buffalo, her first concert was not Feldman's music. It was, I think half of it was Satie, Feldman's direction. And Feldman loved Socrate. And so, you know, like that connection. And then, yeah, he wants to do something for Aki Takahashi, who becomes tremendously important for Morton Feldman's, you know, she becomes his piano muse. Every piano piece he writes after 1980 is for Aki Takahashi. It's like that's the thing he has in his head of what a piano is like, you know, what a pianist is like. And so all of these four people, you know, Satie, Cage, Feldman, Takahashi, are all kind of coming together there. It was such an interesting story that this piece particularly is really about interrelationships of people in a way that some other Cage can be, particularly in the 50s. I mean, everybody's music has a chilliness about it then because they were all interested in sound, right? But then this is really interested in.
When I asked you whether or not Morty had shared that arrangement with Cage, because I didn't know about it, I don't remember Cage ever mentioning it. And I know that Cage and Feldman fell out. Maybe not fell out, that may be too strong, but there was a coolness to their relationship. Around, or I think it's around this time, was it not?
I actually don't know. In my typical, I'm just sitting over here looking at paper at the loft kind of way, that's not, I am not in tune with that. Certainly reading Feldman's writing, I think it's too strong to say he had a chip on his shoulder about Cage. I think he may have had a chip on his shoulder about the way people talked to him about Cage, because he was seen as like the student, which was totally not that.
Although, James, to be fair, if you look at the radio happenings, which we should really do a program just about the radio happenings, which for those of you who don't know, were a series of five radio conversations that Morty and John had. This was 67, something
Yeah, 66 and 67. That's correct.
Right. When you listen to those radio happenings, which we have happily on audio, it's published. You can buy the book with the CD. Morty sort of positions himself as the younger brother. He's always asking Cage's advice. He's complaining about things, and Cage and his infinite Cage wisdom.
There's a little of that. But, you know, the main thing I take from those conversations is how comfortable they were with each other. And you get the sense of they've been doing this for years, sitting around and just speculating about this, that, and the other, or talking about what you wrote, what are you working on now?
But if you look at the language that's going on in Give My Regards to 8th Street, there's a little edginess about
Cage.
You know?
There absolutely is. But I think that's partly, the way that certainly he would have been spoken to about it. So going back to what we talked about before, if you think of Feldman's first Graff piece as being the thing that pushed Cage into chance, to then have, certainly when I was, you know, first learning about this music, the sort of standard way you would think about it is, oh yes, Cage was one who pioneered chance. And look, here's what Earl Brown did with this, and here's what Morton Feldman did with it. And, you know, Feldman did these Graff pieces and so forth. I would be irritated about that. And that people also thought that, well, Feldman should be doing, you know, Feldman was a Cage disciple, when he's coming to it from a very different approach, and his work is just different, and it's what it is. But he was kind of getting glommed together with Cage and under the rubric of indeterminacy. And yeah, I could see getting annoyed by that. And I think that's what I read in Feldman's writing, because at the same time, there's still all this respect.
Goes on and on. And the thing that I was going to add is that when Morty was in the hospital, he was calling John on a daily basis. I don't remember them as being deeply philosophical conversations. I just remember them being friends.
Yeah, and they talk about their work with each other, because that's where they connected, or what art did you see, or, you know, all the things that are in the radio happenings. That's the same kind of conversations that they would have about being composers.
So maybe Morty in his last days was able to free himself from the pressure of outside categorizations, all that nonsense.
Well, things, you know, when it comes right down to the end there, I think, you know, your priorities are clearer, right? And you sort of understand those things. I do know also that John had difficulty with a lot of those late Feldman pieces. I remember him talking to me about, particularly about Three Voices, the one for Joan LaBarbara, where it's three Joan LaBarbaras singing together, two on recording. And he had a hard time with that piece because of the rhythmic regularity of it, because that's just not a Cage thing. He was not
fond of
that. I was
going to say, that's not a complaint against Feldman. That's a complaint against regular rhythms.
That Cage didn't care for. And but in a sense, that piece is also a bit of an outlier. It has that regularity because you've got to synchronize two recordings and a live person. And some of the things that happen in other Feldman pieces where it's much smooshier, where, you know, downbeats are blurred a lot, you know, where things are all those crazy rhythmic things he expects players to do. They're so impossible, which I think Cage would have had more of a connection to. But some of that simplicity and regularity of the later Feldman pieces kind of put John off a bit. But it was just a disagreement about the piece. It's certainly because John was not doctrinaire about, no, you must do things this way or I will cut you off.
Not at all. James, we're going to have to wrap up because I really want to be able to play the whole second movement. Is there anything about this work that you'd like to say that hasn't been said? I know it's going to come out on CD and you're writing about it, so it's going to become available. But anything now, this is a preview, everybody. You're getting a little peek at it.
Yeah, a preview of the forthcoming mode release as soon as it comes out. In rereading over some of the things I had written before about Cheap Imitation, I came across a note that the speculation that I had once was, gosh, I wonder what it would have been like. It's an interesting thought experiment. What if Cage had been more like Ives? Somebody who was discovered late after everything had already happened, right? Because Ives, you know, he wasn't totally unknown, but basically all of this work that nobody really knew anything about until he was no longer really composing it. You know, what if that happened? Like, what if the first piece that had shown up was Cheap Imitation? Like, what if that's the piece where all of a sudden people were like, oh, who is this Cage guy, right? How would you have thought about it differently? That voice was the one that you started with. And then you looked back at the stuff that came before, it would have been quite different. This piece, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about because that connection to Satie is lifelong for him. It's not like it ever went away. It was always that devotion to Satie is underneath it the whole time. And understanding that connection to me, to fully understand that, is probably in some ways more important than understanding the Zen thing. I'm kind of tired of people putting Cage in Zen monk robes, and it's just not, you know, well, in some ways it's kind of offensive because in no way, shape or form could you consider Cage to be a Buddhist.
Absolutely none.
Had no participation or connection to that world in any way other than reading about it. And
my life partner, who is knowledgeable about a lot of religious study things, says he's certainly not a Buddhist, maybe a Taoist, maybe.
No, because I put it on when I was writing about this whole cage and spirituality thing, which I think is really, he's certainly a very, Feldman said it, right? It's, Cage has not so much a musical attitude as a religious one. Absolutely
you
true.
You see that way back in his life.
Way back. That's constant throughout. And the sati thing connects to that. And that, what does that mean? And I think his religion was experimental music. And he found what I called in one of my writings, the way of experimental music. There's the Taoist thing, right? It's the Tao of experimental music. It's
exactly.
his way
exactly.
of that. Doing these chance operations is what's taking him into this this different spiritual place of essentially transcendence, right?
Yes, so. That's exactly right. We have to wrap up, but it's been so great connecting.
Yeah, it has been. Boy, don't get us together and we'll go on all day.
We can do it again. But in the meantime, everybody be on the lookout for the new mode recording of Cheap Imitation with the work by Morty Feldman, which is beyond thrilling.
Lovely.
So take care of yourself, James.
You too, Laura. Thanks so much.
Now let's listen to the second movement of Morton Feldman's 1980 arrangement of John Cage's Cheap Imitation for flute, glockenspiel, and piano. As noted, this will be included in an upcoming CD from Mode Records, John Cage Edition 53, The Works for Piano 2, which will also include Cage's solo piano version of the work, Swinging, Perpetual Tango, and All Sides of the Small Stone for Eric Satie and given secretly to Jim Tenney as a Cohen, this last dating from 1978 and recently discovered in the Tenney archives. The performer is the stellar Aki Takahashi, joined by flutist Margaret Lancaster and David Shively on glockenspiel.
Thank you. The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.